Welcome to At a Crossroads with a Naked Podcaster. I am your host, Jen Taylor. The podcast is for those of you who know that you are built with strength and love that is meant to shine through times of conflict and in times of celebration. Please subscribe, like, hit the button, leave a review, and connect with me. I personally respond to every comment and contact. I cannot wait to engage with you. All the links from the show are in this description. If they are not, I will add them to the comments. Let's get started today. I'm really excited about this. My guest is Andrea Wilson Woods. Andrea, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
I am really excited. Our friend Mickey connected us, and I love everybody Mickey sends me. So I always tag him on that. So that's awesome. We're going to jump in. We have so much great stuff to cover. You have four websites. You have Blue Fairy, Cancer University, Better Off Bald, and Andrea Wilson Woods. So you jump in wherever you want to and start talking about these four websites.
Oh boy. Okay. Well, in my heart of everything I do, I consider myself a storyteller because I just love to tell stories. But if you were going to put a label on it, I'm an author. I'm a patient advocate. I'm a speaker, and I'm actually a podcaster as well, and an entrepreneur. So, where would you like me to start with those?
Well, wow. Let's actually, I think Andrea Wilson Woods, as I've stalked you somewhat, probably tells us a little bit about everything, including Blue Fairy and Cancer U. Is that true?
Yeah.
First of all, you have a book, and one of the links that we have is for a book. I went on Amazon and bought it. And
thank you.
I will not only buy it, I will review it when I'm finished reading.
Thank you. That's the best.
People who are not authors or podcasters have you just can't possibly understand how much it means to leave a review on a book or a podcast. So
yes.
One of those is for the book, and we're going to talk about that more. So maybe... do you think Andrea Wilson Woods kind of encompasses all of them? Because it's your speaking and everything.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Let's jump in there.
Okay. All right. What do you want me to talk about?
Tell me everything you do. You have a blog.
Oh, goodness.
You have a Bravo page for Kudos for You. I love that. You have a podcast and you do some speaking. Mm-hmm. So tell me about the speaking, the blog, the podcast. Fill me in on what's on there.
Okay. Actually, a great example is my first speaking gig of this year in a couple of weeks in person. I'm so excited in person. And the title of it is the speech, and it's a new one. It's called From Skeptical to Spiritual, How Raising My Sister and Losing Her to Cancer Changed My Life. Mm-hmm. And as you indicated before, Jen, all of those things go back to my origin story, if you will. When I was 22 years old, I was living in Los Angeles. I graduated from college and I ended up getting custody of my then 8-year-old sister, Adrian. So she was my sister. I became her legal guardian. I was also her parent. And I raised her all through my 20s until she was diagnosed with stage 4 liver cancer 1 month after her 15th birthday. And
how close were you guys before? Because she was 8 and you were 22. So you're 14 years apart. How well were you connected when you gained custody of her? How close?
I was the first person to hold her when she was born.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So the first 4 years of Adrian's life, I was still in high school. And she was kind of my sidekick, glued to my side. And I helped my mother raise her. And then I wanted to go off to college and move away. And I did. And I still kept in touch. I still visited several times a year. In fact, Adrian had been to LA 2 years prior for a 2-week vacation in the summer. Oh. And when she was 6, which was a lot of fun. And this was supposed to be a 2-week Christmas vacation in December of 1994. That's what it was supposed to be.
Okay.
I should have known something was up because she came with 2 suitcases and one had all her clothes and the other one had all her stuffed animals. So this should have been a clue, but it didn't occur to me. And so we are having our Christmas vacation and our mother calls, and we have the same mother, different fathers, I should say that. Her father died before she was born. And our mother called and said she didn't want to be a mother anymore. And this was the day after Christmas. I didn't put it together at the time, but it was also a few days before my mother's 50th birthday. So I don't know if that had something to do with it. But also our mother was a prescription drug addict and had really, up until that year, had been good about maintaining and really functioning well. But she got caught shooting up morphine at work at the hospital, lost her nursing license, and she'd been kind of in a free-for-all ever since that time. And and that's how I ended up getting custody of Adrian.
Okay, so we're going to jump around. There's a lot to unpack here. I'm glad, because with a 14-year difference, you could have not been that close or not known her real well. Mm-hmm. So getting custody of your sister and then becoming the parent at 22 with a 14-year gap is, like, I've been a parent, that's super tough. So you got out of college. You told me she turned 15, so she gets there when she's 8, and we'll go mm-hmm. back to this. And mm-hmm. right after her 15th birthday, she's diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you get her diagnosed with cancer? Because a lot of times the symptoms are a little innocuous.
Right. Absolutely. I tell people now that you just don't know how fast your life can change until it does. And our life changed in 6 hours. Adrian didn't have any symptoms. The only thing that had been going on was she had a little bit of acid reflux, and she was chewing Tums like they were mints, and she had a physical coming up. So I was keeping that in mind, but also I couldn't control her diet outside the home. So, you know, I wasn't too worried about it. I said, stop eating tacos at school. I mean, I really wasn't worried. And I came home from work and I found her in our living room, curled up in a fetal position, crying and saying she couldn't breathe. And the day before, she was fine. And this was a kid who never cried. So just to even see her cry was very significant. And from that time until we went to her pediatrician, who sent us to the ER, who did a CAT scan, and then the ER doctor walked in and told us she had tumors in her liver and lungs, that was 6 hours. That was it. And she did not go back to school in person. I did not go back to work. And by that evening, we were in an ambulance and they had sent us to Children's Hospital, Los Angeles. So,
wow.
So it was fast.
She had no symptoms at all, which is what I was wondering, because, like, I remember my daughter thinking, you know, living at home and thinking she had the flu and bringing her in. And I remember she peed in the cup, and I looked at the cup and I went, whoa, that right. Like, it was like milk, you know. Ooh. And she was in the ICU, mm-hmm. and they didn't think she'd live with a kidney infection. It's stuff like that where you're like, yeah, you think you might have the flu, let's go to urgent care and get you checked. I mean, they're probably maybe going to give you antibiotics, there's nothing they can really do, and you're in NICU. This is so much more severe. But yeah, I mean, so she had tumors on her liver and her lungs, and that it was the breathing. And what was the pain coming from predominantly at that point?
That's a great question. So our liver does not have pain receptors. Right. And so typically when people feel pain, it is in those advanced stages. And what had happened was her liver had gotten big enough to press on her diaphragm. And that's why she was saying she couldn't breathe, because literally she could not take a breath. She had a swollen abdomen, but I did not know that. I was very fortunate because she, unlike many of her friends, she didn't dress in skimpy clothes. She kept herself fully covered. And so I didn't even know that her abdomen was swollen until that day. And she said it had only been that way for about 2 or 3 days. And it wasn't bothering her, so she didn't say anything. And we went to her pediatrician and he did not like it, sent us to the ER. And we all thought, in the ER and with the doctors, that maybe she had internal bleeding, because she had gone to Coachella a few weeks before, had been pressed up against these metal bars for 12 hours. I think it was the first year of Coachella. And that's what we thought, you know, is it bruised ribs? Is there something bleeding internally? No one was prepared, least of all us or the doctor, for what came back on that CAT scan.
I can't even imagine the doctor looking at the CAT scan and realizing, and then having to go and tell. I can't even imagine that. So he walks in and drops this massive bomb, and you guys are you rushed to the children's hospital?
Yeah. He says, I knew something was wrong when he walked in because of the look on his face, and he wouldn't look at her. And that's a little clue when they don't look at the patient at all, that's a sign. And he wouldn't say her name. And he said, you know, she has tumors in her liver and lungs. We're not equipped to handle this situation. This was the only hospital in Burbank, California, and they only treat adult patients. And he said, we've arranged a transfer to Children's Hospital, Los Angeles. I'm sorry. And he walked out. We were in an ambulance within an hour going to Children's Hospital, Los Angeles. She started chemo a week later.
And I mean, in this process, you've got to, like, you're like, what? Putting your stuff in and trying to even, like, what is tumors? What does it mean to have tumors on your lungs and liver? Like, what, why is she in pain? What's causing me? You know, I mean, like, I don't even know if you would know what questions to ask at that point, because you've just be trying to digest it, kind of. And so you guys are in an ambulance on the way to Children's Hospital. At what point were you both scared? Did it already happen? Were you not sure? Because you're kind of like,
I knew it was bad.
Yeah.
I had this, everyone else thought they were wrong or it was something different. I just had this horrible feeling that something, it was really bad. It wasn't until 2 days later that she actually had a biopsy, and they got to go in there and take the tissue, look at it under a microscope. And that's when they officially diagnosed her. And, you know, I wouldn't say I saw Adrian scared very much. Not really. It was almost like she expected it to. And it was, you know, we can go into, if you like, I had three premonitions. And all of them came true, and never in a million years did I think they would come true, but they all came true with Adrian getting cancer and dying from the cancer. So
I'd love to. And when, at what point did you get these? So go ahead. You left us at the ambulance.
Sure.
So go ahead, jump in.
About the premonitions?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Yeah. I've always known I would outlive everyone I love. I've always known that to my core. And even when Adrian was born with that 14-year age gap, I knew I would outlive her. I just thought she would be in her 50s and I would be in my 70s, but I knew I would outlive her. So there's the first premonition. The second premonition is in my early 20s, I had this sort of irrational fear of cancer that I didn't tell anybody about because it was so irrational. I got this little flyer in the mail from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society to do a marathon to fight cancer. And I signed up. I'm a terrible runner, but I thought I'll do this marathon. It will conquer this ridiculous fear I have about cancer. And I was actually in training for the marathon when Adrian was diagnosed. That fear, I realized when I traced it back, it started in my early 20s after I got custody of her. Mm-hmm. And the last premonition actually happened during that cancer journey. So Adrian was one of those kids who pretty much had looked the same ever since she was 18 months old. And, you know, if you saw baby pictures, you would know it was her. And so it wasn't hard to picture her as an adult. You know, she was already 15. She was already a young woman. And she was really looking forward to college. And during all of this, it came out that she wanted to go to my alma mater, USC, or University of Southern California. And I didn't like that. I thought that was not good enough for her. So I had all these plans. She's going to go to Harvard or Princeton and worst case scenario, Stanford. No, I found out that summer. No, I'm going to USC. I'm staying in Los Angeles. This is where I'm going. And so when she told me that, I kept trying to picture her on campus. I was like, just picture her on campus, you know, walking down Truesdale Parkway. I've lived and breathed on that campus, and I could not see her. Like, I'm going to get teary-eyed early. It was like a jigsaw puzzle I couldn't put together. And I knew. It just, what's it going to happen? So
those are not, well, the cancer, that feeling that you have about cancer and it being scary. I mean, I've had people that have died from cancer in my family, and like, that is a scary word, and it is scary to lose people. That,
yeah,
that one, like I totally get the outliving people. I mean, if I had those premonitions, I'd probably be like, I'm crazy. And yet I still feel this way. So also that's not a happy, that's a lonely feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a lonely feeling. Yeah.
Okay. So you're in the ambulance on the way to the children's hospital, knowing something's definitely wrong.
Right.
And you know, I've been transferred from an adult hospital and it hasn't been as big of a deal. So just that is an in and of itself a terrible thing. Adult hospitals do not deal with kids if they need to be checked in.
Right.
End of story.
Right.
So, I mean, in my mind, I would have been thinking it's not great, but it also is not abnormal. So you're on your way. What is she saying at this point? Anything? What are her thoughts? Did she notice the doctor ignored her?
No, if she did, she didn't say so. I'll tell you what she said. She was so funny. She'd always make me laugh. Right before she went in for the CAT scan, they're wheeling her in and she said, "Hey, Sissy," which is what she called me. "Hey, Sissy, watch it be cancer." And I was like, "Oh, bite your tongue." And we both just laughed and laughed and laughed. So after the doctor dropped that bomb and then he left, we both burst into tears at the same time. So it was like the second time she had cried. And I was still crying when she said, "I was just joking." And I said, "What?" And she said, "I was just joking when I said, hey, watch it be cancer." And she made me laugh. But I knew in that moment that that's what it was. I just knew it. I could feel it. I don't know that I knew exactly how bad it was, but for me, I had to live in a very healthy state of denial to be there for her each and every day.
Right.
I had to be.
And definitely that's going to be a question for me because you get to the children's hospital and how long does it take them to look at that CAT scan? That you said that they did a biopsy.
We're
still less than 24 hours
in. Yeah, we are. Mm-hmm. They scheduled her for a biopsy 2 days later. That was okay. The earliest they could get her in for the biopsy. So the next day, nothing happened, answering more questions, okay, Bringing my guardianship papers, you know, all this stuff, but really nothing happened until the day after. So day number three is the day they did the biopsy. They knew what it was. They came back and said what it was. I mean, I couldn't even pronounce the name of her cancer, which is hepatocellular carcinoma. Couldn't even say it. Okay. It was really
There's
shocking.
There's a lot of things that I can't pronounce and I wouldn't unless I wouldn't unless you know them and you hear them so many times that
yeah,
it becomes part of your vernacular.
Exactly.
So she's in there. How long was she, what was the prognosis? I mean, once they biopsy it and they find out what's the prognosis at that point?
The oncologist we got paired with, who we ended up firing, Dr. No, I would not let him give us numbers, but he essentially did give us numbers when he talked about chemo. And so in his mind, he gave her 6 to 8 months to live and she lived 5 months, 147 days. So.
Okay. Why did you fire him?
I just say, read the book.
Well, I'm going to. I bought it. But yeah.
he wasn't a good match for us. He was really terrible. At that time, Children's Hospital had a bizarre policy where whoever was on call when you got admitted to the hospital was the oncologist you were paired with, regardless of the type of cancer, which was stupid.
Okay.
And he had no real experience in the cancer and she didn't have a pediatric cancer. There is a pediatric liver cancer. She did not have that. She had sort of the normal liver cancer, if you will. And so we weren't really in the right place to begin with. And you mentioned earlier about knowing which questions to ask. And
yeah,
I was very forceful and very persistent, but I didn't always know which questions to ask.
Well, no kidding. I mean, you've been a sister/mom for 7 years, yeah, Navigating everything with a young woman who is hormonal and a teenager. like there's so much to unpack in this situation. So She has a liver cancer. Why were there tumors on her lungs also? Did it spread or was it separate?
It had spread. It had metastasized to her lungs. She was in stage four. Yeah. Yeah. It when I finally got to see the full picture with her lungs, the actual films, it looked like it was snowing in her lungs. That's how bad it was.
When you find the right fit, you decided that you were going to do chemo. The title of the book is Better Off Bald.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
And the picture is of her and she's bald and it's mm-hmm. great. You decided to do chemo. So stage four, there's no stage five for people who don't know that. That's
right.
Stage four is it. And you already have a bad prognosis, which essentially came true because this was a pretty aggressive, severe cancer that
absolutely
advanced.
Yeah.
So what decisions did you have to make about surgery, chemo, radiation? How hard were those to make? I know she was real involved because she's almost an adult, and because of the nature of the relationship, I'm guessing that it was definitely a conversation.
Yeah.
So kind of dive into that a little bit.
Other than her biopsy and when they put the central line in her chest to deliver medication, she didn't have surgery. She wasn't a candidate for surgery because it had spread to her lungs.
Yeah.
And knowing what I know now, we would not have done the chemotherapy. We would have looked for a clinical trial. And I really feel like if Dr. No, I don't want to say had been ethical, but if he had just been realistic, I wish he would have said, yes, we can do this chemo. I mean, he brought it up, but it's not going to do anything. We know it's not going to do anything. You know, you need a clinical trial. We need to transfer you to someone who has expertise in this cancer. You know, by the time I realized that we were in the wrong place, it took me 6 weeks to get her from Children's Hospital over to UCLA and still have her insurance cover the cost. And that was 6 weeks we did not have. And a lot of people don't have when you have such an aggressive cancer. But because I didn't know a lot of things, we agreed to chemo. We were kind of told it was going to be this. The one thing though was there were two drugs, and one of the drugs they knew would cause hearing loss over time. And Adrienne was a musician and she also just loved music, and she was livid. And she just looked at all of us and said, I'd rather be dead than deaf. I'm not doing it. And so we did two things. One, we made sure that she signed permission for her chemotherapy. Like you said, she was a young woman. She did have her own opinions, and we wanted her to feel empowered. So even though we didn't need her signature, we had her sign it. And we made a promise to her that if we ever saw any hearing loss, we would switch the drug. And we did. Ultimately, after I think two rounds, she did have a little bit of hearing loss very beginning. And she said, that's it. And so we switched to a less lethal drug, if you will. But as far as I'm concerned, I don't think it extended her life. And all it did was kill her immune system. So,
which is a downside to chemo. And right. I haven't been in this position where I've had to make this decision. So I can't say what I would do. Although I know that, you know, lots of people say chemo is what saved them. And lots of people sure. say that it did the opposite. And I don't have any answers. I just know that that would be a super tough decision. And like you said, yeah, hindsight's 20/20. If you had known what to ask for and you hadn't lost that 6 weeks and you'd asked for a clinical trial, and then what? I mean, we don't know.
Yeah.
It's just one of those decisions that you don't know. You don't even know the questions to ask.
Right.
I imagine. Yeah.
And I don't want to discourage people. It's just for her situation, the type of cancer, how aggressive it was, a clinical trial was really the best option. And they knew the chemo didn't work. And I just wish she had been really, you know, upfront about it. I wish she hadn't recommended it, but for many other types of cancer, chemo does work quite well. It's just, there are just so many factors and variables that go into every single decision.
Right. Okay. So I want to do something a little bit different because I knew that this would definitely not go in any order. I want to go back to your mom, mm-hmm. if we can.
Sure.
So she was a nurse. Mm-hmm. This is what I've gathered. She was a nurse. She was a prescription drug user.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually she got caught and she didn't want to be a mom anymore. I hope being 50 didn't. I mean, so Andrea, as a mom, I cannot even comprehend. It makes me start to cry to think about looking at any of my kids at any age and saying, I don't want to be mom anymore. That's unfathomable for me. And so, truly, I'm guessing there was something really going on to even contemplate that coming out of your mouth. And I'm 51, so I sure hope that's let's say that wasn't part of it. Go back to you being a kid and your mom, and I get the two dads. That's not a big deal. Same mom. How much did you see her parenting change from you on, like when you were a kid, or did you notice that, or even retrospectively? And when did you realize that she was a prescription drug user? And addicts can be, I mean, you can be a little functioning. And you can function.
Yeah.
I don't know how. I can't even have two beers and function, but whatever. When I'm an idiot. But I know that there are lots of people who are considered functioning addicts, which is a nice way to say that you can continue your addiction and people generally don't know. You can lie about it. So can you go back in time a little more for your mom to set that up for you taking custody?
So, you know, I didn't know my mother was an addict. I mean, I think you know, your childhood, what you have, that's your norm. We always had a junk drawer and it was always full of vials of liquid and alcohol pads and scissors and needles and all kinds of stuff. And I just assumed all nurses were like that. My mother primarily worked graveyard. When she would come home from work in the morning, whatever's in her pockets, she would put in the drawer. And I keep in mind, this was a long time ago. I think it's a lot harder now for nurses and doctors to abuse drugs. They really keep track of the drugs in a much better way than they used to, but not back then. Right. And when you opened our kitchen cabinets, it looked like a pharmacy.
Right.
But again, I just thought this was the bonus of being a nurse. You get to bring stuff home. I don't know. I really did not see it until a couple of things happened. I remember my best friend from high school asked me one time, how come your mother's never happy? Oh. And it was, simple question, but it was like, is she not ever happy? Wait a second. But what really did it was I came home from school. I was driving at that point. So I was 16. And this was still in Birmingham. Adrian was about two and a half. And I came home and I found her staggering. And she's falling down to the ground. She's a toddler. And I freaked out and wanted to take her to the hospital. And my mother had given her something to make her fall asleep because she was crying. And I'm doing my best not to get upset. And when I confronted her about it, like, how could you give a little girl, how could you do that? She just said, oh, it's okay. I know how much to give. I didn't hurt her. And that was the beginning of me really starting to see my mother for who she was. I was very scared going away to college. I was really scared for Adrian. I was very worried all the time. And my mother's life just took a turn for the worse after that. I just didn't know.
It would be hard to have a four-year-old on your own as an addict with your source of responsibility gone, which
is exactly.
Exactly.
I used to tell my mother I was her housewife because she never realized how much I did for her. And I was the full-time, babysitter, and I paid our bills. And once I got my driver's license, I picked up my sister from daycare, dropped her off. I mean, when she got in trouble at daycare, they didn't call my mom. They called me at high school to come pick her up.
Yeah, which is okay. So you said something that I want to reiterate because I'm very familiar with the life of an addict. I grew up with, surrounded by addiction. So I completely understand that part. And you said it's just your normal. And as a kid, there's a couple things. And because somehow foster care, was it a private adoption and guardianship with you? Did your mom just relinquish her rights to you? It didn't go through CPS?
No, I sued her in court and won.
Oh, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Okay. Because depending on which agencies get involved and stuff, that changes a lot of how things go. But as a kid, you don't even realize that you're being an enabler. That's not something that you would even understand. You're just kind of on autopilot. You don't realize how different other lives are.
Yep.
Maybe if you have friends that you go to their house and it's different, but you don't really put that stuff together until later. And then you get pissed because then you realize, because your mom as an adult knew and took advantage of the fact that you didn't. And thank goodness that you were there for your sister as much as you were. But I understand also that struggle between wanting to move on with your life and go to college and do those normal things and having the fear of her being home. So you went to college, she's fine. Your mom gets caught shooting up morphine at work. She tells you the 2-week vacation is going to be extended.
Yeah. It's going to be permanent. Yeah.
And so she just kind of said it was going to be permanent. You take her and you take care of her. I don't want to do it anymore. That was pretty much how that conversation went.
She said she didn't want to be a mother anymore. And I just told her right then in that phone conversation, I said, if I take her now, I'm never going to give her back. I will never give her back. Okay. And my mother was like, oh, okay, whatever. You know, my mom had already, you know, made the decision in her mind. And 8 months later, she did try to come back and said that she had gotten her life together and to send Adrian home. Now, keep in mind, she wasn't keeping in touch with Adrian during this time. She wasn't asking how things were. She wasn't checking in. And that's eventually I ended up suing her so I could get full permanent legal and physical custody. So
good for you, Andrea. All right. Woo. That is great. Now, how involved was your mom the next 7 years though? Well, that first year, obviously she wasn't, and she said she got her life together. Did she?
No, not really. No, she never got her nursing license reinstated. Never.
Okay. That was one of my questions. And is she still alive?
Unfortunately, yes. She just had her 77th birthday.
Well, my dad was a raging, nasty alcoholic addict. And when he died, it was a relief. So I can understand that.
Thank you.
Yes. No, that I 100%. I mean, and people look at me like I'm crazy. I'm like, you don't understand when you are faced with one of the meanest, most abusive addicts in your life that has never been a source of anything happy and has made other people's lives miserable over and over again. And that person dies. He died. I didn't do anything, you know, like he died of a heart attack drunk at the table and it was a relief. So I feel like people who lose their parents, like my husband, and miss them, you don't realize how lucky you are.
Yeah. That's a good way to phrase it.
Right. I have had a parent and I was relieved. So anyway, I understand how you feel. Was she ever involved in that whole 7-year period very much? And she never really cleaned up her act? And
she never, I don't think, fully cleaned up her act. She's never admitted that she's an addict ever. And she became involved up until the actual court case. You know, Adrian went to visit once without me. Usually I always tried to go because I just didn't trust our mother to put her back on the airplane. So she was a little bit more involved. But not a lot, certainly not on the day to day.
Right. Okay. What happened in that dynamic when you got the cancer diagnosis?
My mother wanted me to transfer her to St. Jude's Children's Hospital because that was closer to her real family. I'm using air quotes for the people who are listening. And I said, well, we'll look into it, but you know, we're not just going to up and move to Tennessee just because. And we ended up cutting off contact with my mother because every time she called, all she did was curse me out or Adrian, or it was really terrible. Right. And she was belligerent and, you know, and so, yeah, it just, we didn't stay in touch with her. So.
Okay, good. Well, I kind of wanted to, like, my brain needed to wrap that up. So here you are, you have the diagnosis, you're at the children's hospital and you decide to get chemotherapy. You took her off the medicine that's made it so that she started losing her hearing. I applaud that. Did she expect her life to be short?
I think she did.
Okay.
I think she, even though she very much wanted to live, you know, if anything, she had had a really serious bout with depression. Mm-hmm. She was suicidal when she was 12 years old. And so we had gone through a lot with her to get her to a place where she was really going in the right direction, happy for, you know, who she was, being herself. And that cancer diagnosis just kicked everything into high gear. And I can look back now and say, wow, man, she just made a bucket list. And I just didn't want to acknowledge it, but she did. She made a bucket list and tried to do everything she possibly could in the very short amount of time that she had. So I think she knew. She felt like that she caused the tumors, because in Chinese medicine, the liver is the organ of anger. And she had so much pent up anger toward our mother and also toward our father, for her father, for dying, because she never got to meet him. Right. And I watched her. It's in the book. It's when I really knew that she knew. She worked consciously to let go of that anger. She really did.
Amazing. So now she passed away. Your whole life is consumed by this for absolutely that 147 days.
Yeah.
I mean, consumed is probably an understatement, and as is hers. So now let's kind of talk a little bit more. There are four websites. And tell me about, she passed away, and what that was like for you, and then how long it took you to do different websites, and why you did. I mean, I know why, because you lost somebody that you love and you want to make it easier. I only interview entrepreneurs, and every one of our goals is to make it faster, easier, and more supported for someone else going through the same thing. So I know your why from that perspective, mm-hmm. but specifically, you completely changed the trajectory of your life from yep. this. After she passed away, you could have mm-hmm. gone back to your old job doing your thing, but it completely changed. So kind of take us through that 147 days and her death, and then what with you?
Yeah, I lived in a very healthy state of denial. I knew deep down where we were going and what was going to happen. But I mean, I could not even let myself think about it. I couldn't, in that time when she was sick, I couldn't think about a life without her. Like, that was just at that point unfathomable to me. She was the most important person in my life. I loved her more than anyone I've ever loved in my whole life. I loved her unconditionally. And I couldn't even picture it. And I'm actually working on the next book, which covers this period that you're talking about, sort of okay. the after, and going back and looking at some of my emails and things, it's tough. It's really tough. The first yeah. year I tried really hard to just make sure everybody knew that I was going to be okay, even though that wasn't true at all.
And, I was like, were you okay?
I was not okay.
Okay.
And then when we hit that first anniversary, I was devastated, and I finally sort of let the grief start to seep in, and I became suicidal, and I really just needed a way to channel my grief. And it wasn't my life dream to start a nonprofit, not in any way, shape, or form. I was trying to volunteer for an organization. I mean, I was trying to see what else was out there. And ultimately, at the end of the day, there wasn't a single organization in the US doing anything in that very specific type of cancer that killed Adrian, which I knew based on what I learned about the disease, that it was only going to increase in the US, which it has. And it's one of the most common cancers worldwide.
Really?
And it, okay. Yeah. And so okay. it really became this, well, nobody else is doing anything about this. I need to do something. It really just came down to that. Like, nobody's doing anything. And so that's how my nonprofit Blue Fairy, the Adrian Wilson Liver Cancer Society, was born.
I mean, can we jump into, I know sometimes in cancer, with cancer patients, the end is painful and you know it's coming and it's almost a relief. Was that the case with you guys? And what did Adrian leave you with? Like, you said she always made you laugh and mm-hmm. she was expecting it. And by the end, you are definitely expecting it. I want to touch on that first if we can. And then I definitely have another question for you.
Okay. There's a great story in the book, so I don't want to ruin it. I won't ruin it, but I had to fight like hell to get her home. I really did.
Okay.
If I had followed doctor's orders, she would have been put on a respirator. She would have died in hospital, and I probably would have had to pull the plug. And there was no way in hell I was going to do that.
Right.
And so I ended up getting her home, and she was lucid and awake. And so she could be in her own bed and surrounded by people who loved her. So I always tried to remind myself that if nothing else, she had a good death. And her last words were, "I love you, Sissy."
Now I want to talk about the aftermath of that, because that's a really intense 6 month period of time. And you mentioned that you were suicidal. So
I don't know how I got through those first couple months. I really don't. I have no idea, except that I just kept kind of moving forward. And if people wanted me to do something, I said yes. I don't know how I got through it. It was incredibly difficult. And even after starting Blue Fairy, it was still really hard. And for a couple more years, I continued to act and I continued to teach. That's what I was doing when Adrian was diagnosed. But I just didn't care anymore about acting. I had no desire whatsoever to continue down that path. And teaching, you know, was good, but I didn't have this burning desire to be a teacher. I'm a good teacher, but I just didn't have a desire to do it. I became a teacher to be on Adrian's schedule so I could be home in time for her. That's the only reason I became a teacher. And so it really wasn't until a few years after Adrian died that I began to radically change, as you said, my life's trajectory.
Well, and it takes a while. I mean, there's a lot to digest. I lost my son. He went missing at 23 and almost to the day, 4 years, almost to the day. He went missing on August 6th and we got the call on August 3rd, 4 years later, that they found his body. They matched his body with the remains. Now, it took me over another year to talk about it. And I always speculated, and this is my point, not my story, but this is my point. I always speculated that the worst thing I would ever go through is losing a child. If that ever happened, that would be the worst thing to live through. So that is what you live through. And the only thing that would keep me from not wanting to check out would be that I had other kids.
Mm.
And that is true. And you did not.
Right.
And so I understand how harrowing that is, and that you have to confront a side of you that's very dark and very alone and angry and sad, and every emotion mixed into one. So I completely understand where that comes from.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
And he was a long-term foster kid. So I'd had him from 10 until he aged out and then he stayed in 23. So similarly, it wasn't like I gave birth biologically and then, you know, something happened. So I can empathize with
what you
went through. Right. And I know other people who have had losses can empathize with that, that there wasn't much keeping you grounded.
Right.
You don't know how you get through it. Like one foot in front of the other. You're a marathon. You train for a marathon. I mean, I had a running coach once that said, running is the easiest thing you'll ever do, but it's also the hardest thing you ever do. And all you have to focus on is putting one foot in front of the other. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
Right? It helped. Like, it did. Oh yeah.
It helped. You are literally focusing on one step. That is it.
It really did help. So I'm glad you brought that up. Like I said, I was training when Adrian was diagnosed. Mm-hmm. So I didn't end up doing the marathon I was supposed to do. And so the following year I did the LA marathon. And yeah, it really helped to have something to do, a long-term goal to shoot for, to have to run every day, to, you know that I was going to complete the marathon, and that definitely helped. But you know, in the house, I was just so sad, and my long-term boyfriend, who was really the only father figure Adrian ever had, they were very close, and he still has a son who was younger, and they were actually very close in age as opposed to being Adrian. So we had a little family, and he became angry, really angry. And so that made things even worse, because we were so far apart from each other and our grief took us in such different directions, and the relationship didn't work out, but I knew it wouldn't, you know, I knew.
So you're looking at all this information because after the experience you went through, you want to know how can other people get help and how can you be involved as a on the other side of this situation, right? And there was nothing. So I mean, I would think that that is, on one hand, what a devastating bummer, because it would have been cool to just get involved with something and help.
It would have been a lot easier.
And on the other hand, it gave you something completely different that you focused on, which was Blueberry. Yes.
It did. It very much did.
Now, did you, okay, so you did, I have your websites up. Blueberry is specifically about the liver cancer that is so prevalent.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's all of that information. It's the community, the mission. You can connect. It's very specific for that. And So you have like, it links doctors and patients and what you do and who you are and how people can help, essentially.
Yeah. The mission is to prevent, treat, and cure primary liver cancer, specifically hepatocellular carcinoma, through research, education, advocacy. And when we founded the organization, our goal was to, we want to put ourselves out of business, which is kind of unheard of in the charity world, but we want to get to the point where we are no longer needed. And we're not even close to that yet, but I can say that now if someone is diagnosed with advanced disease, like Adrian was, there are at least drugs that can, that are palliative, again, not curative, but, can really help people. People are living much longer with advanced disease with a relatively good, if not very good, quality of life. So we're making these sort of baby steps, if you will. We're making some progress.
But
it's taking a long time.
And you know that's huge because you lived through it, not knowing what questions to ask. So that was what I was going to ask you. How much has changed? First of all, what year did Adrian pass away?
She died October 9th, 2001.
Okay. So it's been 10 and
20
a half years.
Yeah. Oh, wow. 20 years.
20 years. I'm sorry. Holy cow. Yeah. So you've seen 20 years plus of this whole situation. Yeah. Welcome to 2022, Jen. It's learn to count day. I am 51. Yeah. So you are seeing progress. It's slow, but you are seeing progress.
We are. Yeah. I mean, there was so little available that when I asked for information about her disease, we got all these one pagers on the chemo, and it was like, well, first I want to understand what she has before we look at what the drugs do. And there was nothing. And so the surgeon who did her biopsy made copies from his medical textbooks, brought me just a stack of paper. And here I was educated and I did not understand what I was reading. And so we went out and bought a medical dictionary, and we also bought Gray's Anatomy, and I was translating it. And I know that really just stuck, like it really stuck. That there were no patient education materials in layman's terms that were super easy to understand. And that was actually one of the very first things we tackled, is we have an ongoing educational program.
Good. Because that is overwhelming. You can't possibly know what questions to ask, even when you have it in lay terms and it makes some sense.
But if you don't even know what you're reading.
No, you
really
can't.
Difficult.
And how lost and alone and overwhelmed. But how great that doctor at least did that. I mean, there was so little, he brought you what he could. So then we move on to cancer.university. It's CancerU. So when was this launched? And this is more, I don't want to say generic, but it's not specific to liver cancer.
No, it's not. I co-founded Cancer University in spring of 2018. So it's been about 3.5 years or so. And we totally bootstrapped the business. It's not a charity. It's a for-profit social impact health tech startup. And what we do is Cancer U is an online platform and to educate, engage, and empower cancer patients and caregivers to your point, all types of cancer. Right. And we use coaching, we use courses, and we use community. And that really came out of a problem that I saw with my own nonprofit and with other advocacy groups, that having educational materials are fantastic, but it's not enough. It's kind of like giving someone a fish versus teaching them how to fish. So I've been coaching pro bono for over a decade, cancer patients and caregivers, because I always got phone calls and messages, and I mean, you name it, like people would reach out, and it started in liver cancer, but then it started to expand, and it got to the point where I just couldn't handle and really help people at the level I wanted to. And I didn't have it in my heart to charge people because I know what it's like to have $20. If you're lucky in your bank account, I know that feeling. And so Cancer U is free to anyone in need. We make it very easy. And yeah, that's how it came about. It was just trying to solve this problem of, okay, education's great, but people actually need action steps. You know, you need to empower them. And I was able to do that one-on-one, but I certainly wasn't able to do that at scale. And Cancer U allows me to do that at scale.
Oh, I got it. Okay. Okay. And that's, you are giving that away for anyone who wants a lifetime membership on Cancer U.
Yes.
Through the podcast and the information.
Absolutely.
In the description. So that I understand now that you were trying to, yeah, one-on-one is amazing for the person that you're working with because you have such a high level of connection, yeah. But you're right. So Cancer U did that. And then what about Andrea Wilson Woods? When did that launch in the middle of all this? And what is your life looking like now? You said you didn't love teaching and you didn't love mm-hmm. acting anymore. Mm-hmm. So bridge that gap for me.
Okay. I launched my website in grad school, actually.
Okay.
And the thesis for my master's degree was the first draft, Better Off Bald. And so it's out there somewhere in the ecosystem. The really bad first draft is out there in the world.
That's the best. I kept mine for a long time. Okay.
So my master's degree is in writing and it was a way for me to go back to school and also hold me accountable. And I knew I wanted to write this book, but I knew it was going to be incredibly difficult to do. And so that's when I launched that website. I used to do coaching, career coaching. I don't as much anymore, although there is an email right now in my inbox, someone asking me about career coaching. And and I was very good at it. Again, I was very good at it. I love helping people. I'm very good at helping people with career transitions, but it just wasn't my burning passion. And so now I really focus all of my time on Blue Fairy and Cancer U. And then I do the occasional speaking engagement. And I write, right? And working on the second book right now, very early stages of the second book.
Yay. So as we're wrapping this up, I tell all my guests, I'm going to ask you a question at the end. And I think actually from your experience as the caretaker, the people that don't have the diagnosis, what did you do or would you do differently that made the situation the best it possibly could be for Adrian? And for you, actually.
What I tell people is that you have to do what the patient wants. And as a caregiver, you just want to make it better. You just want to fix it. And I've had every patient I've ever interviewed has said to me that the caregivers have a more difficult time because the patients are so focused on just being healthy, getting well, and that's it. The caregivers do everything else. And I didn't really have a full comprehension of what that was until someone named it once for me. And they said, let's break this down. You're your sister's assistant. You're her chauffeur. You're her cook. You're her maid, you know, and they broke down every single thing that I was doing for my sister during that time. And it was like, wow, yeah, that's overwhelming. I could not find support for myself. I think that has gotten a lot better, but I desperately wanted some kind of support. And there's a story in the book. I dragged Adrian to this teen support group that Children's Hospital hosted, and she had a meltdown and we left. And it was me trying to fix my need. But she told me, she said, I don't want that. I don't want to be around other sick kids. That doesn't help me. And so I just tell caregivers, one, you know, what the patient wants, they want. It may not be what you want. And two, get support just for you. Find your own support, not your friends, not your family. Find actual support group or therapist or whatever will work for you. Because I couldn't find it during that time.
Andrea, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story. I appreciate you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me.